This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Remember the story of Romans becoming stupider due to lead in their plates and goblets? Mercury poisoning not only kills tens of thousands of people a year, it drifts to the farthest corners, even the poles, and reduces IQ, just like lead. Scientist Ari Feinberg from the Spanish National Research Council explains the travels of this heavy metal in the stratosphere. On January 10th, five major institutes reported 2024 was definitely the hottest year ever recorded. Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith and I thrashed through the latest greenhouse news. I'm Alex. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
There is news about toxic mercury in the atmosphere and how it travels to the far wilderness and even the poles. High doses of mercury in food cause severe damage to the nervous system. A 2021 study on global health effects of future atmospheric mercury emissions predicts 29,000 deaths a year from mercury poisoning by 2050. Worse, mercury reaching the womb leads to loss of IQ points for masses of babies. We need to know how this works. Dr. Ari Feinberg is a postdoctoral fellow with the Atmospheric Chemistry and Climate Group at the Spanish National Research Council. Years ago, Feinberg began his investigations into the travels and operations of mercury. Following a stint at MIT and degrees from ETH Zurich, Ari now works with Professor Alfonso Saez Lopez, the lead author of their new paper. From Madrid, Ari Feinberg, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So mercury is a silvery liquid at room temperature. It is useful and it is toxic. How did your fascination with this element begin?
Well, for me, I think it's quite a unique element, as you said, being a liquid metal at room temperature and as well being so volatile. So my fascination with mercury actually started as an undergrad student where I was working within in a lab, and this is quite difficult because it's very volatile. You always have to work in the fume hood, and as well, it sticks to everything, so it sticks to tubing lines, and this can be quite difficult for experiments. So that kind of inspired me to leave the lab and work more on the theoretical side, modeling the global cycle of this element.
And mercury is a heavy metal, and it is quite heavy. How does a metal manage to float around in the upper atmosphere?
So mercury is quite volatile, which means that it's easily emitted from surfaces. And once it's in the air, the main form of mercury, we call it elemental mercury, that actually is quite long-lived in the atmosphere. So the oxidation time is somewhere around 6 months. And until it gets oxidized, it can travel quite far distances within that 6 months. And so it can reach to even remote regions, to the polar regions, and it also can go all the way up to the stratosphere, which is what we looked at in this study.
Yeah, one of the strongest sources of things going into the stratosphere, it takes a lot to get particles up there, like volcanoes or nuclear explosions. Well, maybe we should get back to basics. Talk to us about the overall cycle of mercury, how it works from the ground to the air to the waterways and back again.
Mercury is emitted by several different types of sources. So first you have anthropogenic sources like coal combustion, also artisanal gold mining is a dominant source of mercury. So that's where they use mercury to extract gold from sediments. And later they burn this off, and so that releases mercury into the atmosphere. Another source of mercury is natural, so that's from volcanoes and other geogenic sources, but this is quite small. This is only maybe 5%. Once in the atmosphere, this mercury can travel around. It can be oxidized, which means it can react into forms that are more soluble and eventually be rained out back to the ocean or to land surfaces. And the interesting thing there is that once this is back on the surface, it doesn't stay there. So it's quite a tricky element. It's due to its volatility, it can be revolatilized back into the atmosphere from oceans and land. So a lot of the emissions of mercury that we currently have, actually around 60%, these are recycling emissions from land and ocean. And so they're somewhere in between natural and anthropogenic. They're historically mainly anthropogenic mercury, but that continue recycling through natural systems.
And your new paper with Dr. Say Lopez is titled Role of the Stratosphere in the Global Mercury Cycle. Now, all along, scientists presumed airborne forms of mercury were transported by winds and weather in the troposphere lower down. Your research found mercury farther up in the stratosphere, and it is chemically active up there. Things are changing. How can non-scientists picture the way mercury transforms way up there and why it matters?
So to get up into the stratosphere, you either have to be long-lived, which is the case for mercury, or you have to be propelled up there, like what you said before, in a big volcanic eruption. And so for the case of mercury, having this lifetime of 6 months, that's enough for a significant portion of mercury to get up into the stratosphere, which is the layer that's about 12 kilometers above the ground, and going up until 50 kilometers above the ground. And so the chemistry that happens there is actually quite unique. And mercury there can react in a number of different ways, but these tend to form a species of mercury, mercury chloride, which is very resistant to breaking apart by light or other reactions in the atmosphere. And so this species, the stratosphere acts as kind of a chemical factory, which is transforming mercury into a longer-lived oxidized species that can then be transported around and eventually deposited back at the Earth's surface.
And does it land in particular spots? I mean, we know there are mercury hot spots of origins, and you show them on maps in your paper, hot spots in India and China with some elevated places, maybe in the Mediterranean and South America. But how is it getting distributed, and does it fall back right near where it came from, or is it getting as far as our natural parks and all the wilderness that we think is untouched?
Yeah, so that's an interesting aspect with the stratosphere, is that the transport pathways in the stratosphere, things tend to get into the stratosphere through the tropics, and then they tend to leave either farther north or farther south in what we call the mid-latitude. So thinking about between, let's say, 40 and 60 degrees, either north or south. And so here you can have transport of mercury going even towards the poles in these remote regions coming out of the stratosphere there. So mercury, even though it's emitted mainly in industrial regions, we find mercury in ecosystems all around the world, you know, even going to the Antarctic and the Arctic. And this can be quite dangerous, actually, for communities that live within the Arctic, because they eat fish, which are affected by this mercury pollution.
So if humans had not mined mercury, I think some of the old mines were in Alameda, Spain, and places like that. We put them into thermometers. We put them into all sorts of instruments, all sorts of uses. If we had not dug them up, would there be less mercury cycling around in the atmosphere and the land and the waters?
Definitely. So there's been a lot of research into this, and the latest kind of best estimates are that humans have increased the amount of mercury in the atmosphere by about 5 times natural levels. And in the ocean, in the surface ocean, this is around 2.5 to 3 times natural levels. So we're talking about, you know, up to 3 times more mercury in the surface ocean than should be there in a natural case. And so we've had a huge perturbation on this elemental cycle going back, you know, even thousands of years is when humans started being fascinated by this element and taking advantage of some of its chemical properties. But this has definitely had consequences even until today.
And is mercury deposition from the atmosphere a significant public health threat?
Yeah, so because mercury is volatile, the atmosphere is one of the main transport pathways that brings mercury from emission sources in more industrial areas to, you know, remote areas. So mercury has, you know, consistently been listed as one of the top 10 chemical threats by different international and national environmental agencies. Yeah, one of the issues is that if we continue to emit mercury, the problem only becomes worse. So mercury is a chemical element. It's, you know, it doesn't get destroyed as an element. The only permanent loss is when it's buried in marine sediments after a thousand years or so. So we continue to suffer from pollution in the historical past. And so that's why it's critical for us to cut emissions of mercury in order that this contamination doesn't continue building up in the future and further endangering seafood safety.
And we know mercury is harmful to animals, but I think you did an earlier study on mercury and plants. So what did you find there?
Mercury is taken up by forests. This is actually one of the main loss pathways of mercury from the atmosphere. Around a third of mercury in the atmosphere is taken up on land by forests. And so for the plants, there's not a ton of information about how harmful this could be. But through the plants, mercury can get into soils and into also terrestrial ecosystems. So there's been some studies done looking at how insects in terrestrial environments and also the predators in the terrestrial food chain, like birds, they can have high levels of mercury, which might as well affect their physiology.
So if forests are sort of capturing mercury, I presume there must be a fair amount of mercury in wildfire smoke.
Yes, that's also an important terrestrial source of mercury. So these forests take up mercury, but as we see, like, that storage of mercury is temporary. And if these forests are disturbed through wildfires, the mercury can get back into the atmosphere and enter again into the cycle.
And adding to the whole cycle, humans continue to mine more mercury and emit more into the air from, as you say, coal-burning power plants and crude gold mining as another source. I thought there was a United Nations convention to reduce dangerous mercury. What was the intent there, and where does that stand?
Yeah, so there's been a UN convention, the Minamata Convention on Mercury, which entered into force in 2017. So this is a very new convention. They have a number of policies which are aimed at addressing mercury pollution. And so one of them is the goal to stop mercury mining. Another one is that countries, parties to the Minamata Convention, should apply the best available technology to try and reduce emissions of mercury from coal power plants and other industrial sources. Another part of the convention is that countries that do have gold mining going on in their territory, that they take measures to try and address this. And so this convention is still quite new, but there are some positive results coming out of all of these global policy efforts. In another study, which I published last year, we looked at the trends of mercury in the atmosphere, in the Northern Hemisphere, and we could actually see that the amount of mercury has been declining in the atmosphere over the last 15 years. And so this is showing that what countries have been doing to try and tackle this pollution issue, that might be working.
It's interesting you mentioned the Northern Hemisphere. Since 2020, about 88% of mercury production came from China, with Tajikistan, Russia, and Mexico amongst the principal miners. And all of this and most of the industrial consumption is in the Northern Hemisphere. Are mercury emissions staying in the global north?
The majority of global emissions are in the global north. In the global south, the major emission source is from artisanal and small-scale gold mining. And so this is an important source in Latin America and as well in many parts of Africa and as well say Southeast Asia. And so that's the main emission source of mercury from those regions.
And will ongoing climate change affect the mercury cycle, including airborne aerosols of this heavy metal?
Yes, so there's a number of ways that climate change could affect the mercury cycle, going from what we looked at in our study, which was how in the future the transport of mercury into the stratosphere will become faster. And so this could affect how mercury becomes distributed within the atmosphere. But that's just, you know, one aspect that could change in the future. Other studies have looked into how food chains will change in the future, which could affect how mercury bioaccumulates in the environment. Other studies looking at, you know, how, let's say, forest growth will affect uptake of mercury onto land. And so here there's a lot of unknowns, and I think it's important to continue to research the many different global change processes that might affect mercury pollution.
Do we have enough mercury-free alternative technology so we could stop digging up more and spreading it everywhere?
That's a great question. So there are, for some processes, there are good mercury alternatives. I think one of the most challenging is the gold mining issue, where there are many NGOs and other organizations looking to introduce gold mining techniques that don't involve mercury, but this is still an area of active efforts.
And is the mercury in the stratosphere, is the role of that somewhat, is it significant or is it pretty small compared to what's traveling around in the troposphere? How would you answer that one?
So what we found in our study is that, you know, depending on what level you take for the stratosphere, around, you know, between 5 to 50% of the mercury passes through the stratosphere. So quite a big fraction of the mercury is traveling through the stratosphere. Another aspect that we looked into is how important the stratosphere is for the transport of mercury from one hemisphere to another. So from the northern hemisphere, where most of the emissions are happening, to the south. And what we found is that it's almost half-half. So half of the mercury that's traveling from the northern hemisphere all the way to the southern hemisphere is taking the route through the stratosphere. And so this is, you know, an important transport pathway for mercury within the overall global atmosphere.
So we have listeners in Australia. Should they be worried that mercury is coming down with the rain? And also, how significant is this as a public health threat right now? I mean, should listeners be staying up late night worrying about mercury, or is this just something else we need to know about and get control of?
Both are great questions. So I would say the researchers definitely are staying up thinking about this, but I don't know if they're worried, you know, in the day-to-day with all the other aspects that we have in our lives. But I would say that mercury, as a health threat, I think it's a big concern for me, at least for the future. You know, if we continue to emit, the risks in seafood will get worse and worse. But on the other hand, there are promising signs in terms of 151 countries coming together in this UN convention to tackle mercury pollution. I think that's a great example of how countries could collaborate on this issue. And as well, I mean, with seafood, thinking about seafood, which is our main intake of mercury, we also have to be cautious about saying that, you know, listeners shouldn't eat seafood, because seafood also has a lot of great nutrients. It's an important part of a lot of people's diet. And there has been some research that actually the benefits or the beneficial nutrients in seafood outweigh the drawbacks from having higher mercury. For me, it's more of a concern that as we continue to emit mercury, that balance might change as you know, we're adding these contaminants into the ocean. We shouldn't be alarmist about the mercury issue and have it stop us from continuing including fish in our diet. On the other hand, we should follow the national advisories about how much fish different groups should have each week or each month. And we should try to make choices that reduce the amount of mercury being emitted into the environment. So, for example, supporting renewable energies, you know, investigating where the gold that we're consuming is coming from, and making smart choices as an individual as well.
And your work literally added a whole new layer to what we know about mercury in the atmosphere. But what don't we know? What research needs to keep going on this?
So I think, you know, we've opened up that the stratosphere might be an important transport pathway for mercury, but there's still a lot that we need to research about how this transport through the stratosphere could affect mercury at the surface, as well as how the mercury cycle in general is going to change with climate change. One aspect is how human society will change. Are we going to reduce the emissions of mercury in the future? But another aspect is increasing temperatures. How will this affect the methylation of mercury, which is how it gets to be more toxic, and as well how general transport of mercury will change in the future.
From Madrid, we've been speaking with Dr. Ari Feinberg from the Blas Cabrera Institute of Physical Chemistry, part of the Spanish National Research Council. Find out more with my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Ari, thank you for looking up and for spending time with our listeners.
Great. Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We just lived through two insanely hot years on planet Earth. Places flooded, dried right out, and burn. Carbon stored in plants went into the sky along with toxic ash when plastic cities burn. The Big Five climate tracking agencies all reported about 2024 on January the 10th. Were the past 2 years just freak time, or is it the start of rapid global heating? To discuss results and reality, we are joined by Canadian climate system scientist Paul Beckwith. After lecturing on climate science at two universities, Paul produces YouTube video explainers for Breaking Climate Science. I use them. From Ottawa, Canada, Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
So, five reports came out from the UK Met Office, NASA, Copernicus in Europe, Berkeley Earth, and the World Meteorological Organization. Although carefully avoiding words of alarm, to me these graphs and maps seem more like reports from a war zone. What do you think, Paul?
Yes, they're certainly surprising and maybe wake-up calls to some people, hopefully, because 2024 and 2023 were literally off the charts for atmospheric temperatures, for sea surface temperatures, for ocean heat content, and all the other metrics that one might look at. And they clearly show that we've left 1.5 Celsius above so-called pre-industrial in the rearview mirror, I think.
And how much hotter than pre-industrial is this planet?
Well, the pre-industrial, for all of these different groups that did the atmospheric temperatures, is pretty much 1850 to 1900, the average of that time period. And the Berkeley group came up with 1.62 degrees Celsius for 2024 above pre-industrial. And the other groups were mostly over 1.5, but they were not quite as high as 1.62. And I just also want to remind people that when the original 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius numbers were talked about in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, the pre-industrial was loosely defined as the year 1750. And if you look at the temperature difference between 1750 and the new baseline definition, 1850 to 1900, we've got about 0.15, 0.2 degrees Celsius difference. So we're rapidly on our way to 2 degrees at this point, 2 degrees Celsius.
Wow. Well, the two lower global average warming estimates showing below 1.5 degrees are from American government-sponsored NASA and NOAA. Overseas, the UK Hadley Center, Europe's Copernicus, and the World Meteorological Organization are all higher than 1.5 and close to or above that 1.6 that you mentioned of current warming. Are the Americans already lowballing global warming? We have to ask.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I find that one of the most reliable and accurate sources, prescient sources, is actually the papers that James Hansen puts out. And he's talked about exceeding 1.5 for a long period of time. So 2024 was the first calendar year, but actually each month going back to, halfway through 2023 was mostly exceeding the 1.5 already. And Hansen's also attributed it to the spike upwards in the last few years to the reduction of sulfur from shipping fuels by the International Maritime Organization, which is a group within the UN, I believe. So they've really tightened the controls on sulfur in commercial shipping fuels, and as a result, there's less sulfur over the oceans and the routes that they ply, which are mostly in the northern hemisphere. And as a result, there are fewer cloud condensation nuclei, so fewer low-lying clouds, so therefore more sunlight is reaching the surface of the planet, both the land and ocean surfaces, and causing a great acceleration of heating in the last few years.
Paul, I know you studied the poles and the ice world, and you carefully watch ocean temperatures, but let's start out with the land where most of us live. According to the country breakdown at Berkeley Earth, our Canada has not warmed by 1.5 degrees C. No, we heated up twice that, to 3.1 degrees C on average in 2024. So it's no wonder Canadian forests burned beyond recognition the past 2 years. Talk about the reality of climate change in Canada.
We're seeing a lot more weather extremes in Canada. In a warmer world, there's more water vapor in the atmosphere. That water vapor has convective uplift and feeds more storms, larger storms that cause more disruption. So the extreme weather events in Canada have gotten so bad, actually, that Lloyd's of London in 2019 said that they weren't going to reinsure insurance companies in Canada any longer. They're one of the world's largest reinsurance companies, which insures the insurance companies. So if you're in the insurance business, then people are having a tough time with their models and with their knowledge on climate change, and they're basically saying that some regions just are going to become uninsurable. If you want to talk about insurance, what about the people in the Los Angeles region in Southern California? Many insurance companies are not insuring houses in regions like that now because the risks are just too large. The extreme weather events in Canada, in the last few years have skyrocketed, whether it be large hailstorms, whether it be the wildfires that burned down half the town of Jasper, flooding in other regions, and, other large wind events. I mean, it's just things are just accelerating very, very fast in terms of extreme weather events. It's not just in Canada. This is recognized, becoming more and more recognized around the world. I was just reading a report put out by the World Economic Forum. These are the people that hold the Davos conference each year, and this conference is coming up, and they always precede the conference with a report, and it looks at risks, global risks. It's an assessment based on feedback from CEOs of companies and scientists and, a wide range of people from different academic backgrounds and industry, and they assess risks, planetary risk, over, say, the next year or two, over a time frame of 5 years out and 10 years out. And the top risks by far are climate change-related risks, like extreme weather events, the risks of abrupt tipping points, and the risks to biodiversity, and things like that. Also, misinformation was high up on their list. But the climate change risks weren't top for the next year or two, according to most of the people that were surveyed. But in 5 years, they're more prevalent, and in 10 years, they dominate the situation of global risk.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Radio EcoShock.
Canadian scientist Paul Beckwith joins Alex Smith with a report on climate disruption in 2024.
For our European listeners, Copernicus Science and Satellite Service says, quote, 2024 was the warmest year on record for Europe, with an average temperature of 10.69 degrees C, and that is 0.28 degrees C higher than the previous warmest year, which was 2020. This 2024 temperature is 1.47 degrees C above average for the 1991 to 2020 reference period. and that's pretty recent, and it's 2.92 degrees C above the 1850 to 1900 level. So that's almost 3 degrees C above pre-industrial last year in Europe. Nobody has managed to skate on the canals in the Netherlands since February 2021. Even the seasons have changed in Europe. It's all very strange, isn't it, Paul?
Yeah, of course, we have to remember that the numbers reported by the five agencies on January 10th, those are average numbers. Some of them divided up into land, ocean numbers, but you know, the main point to remember is that as you move to higher and higher latitudes, there's amplification of the temperature. So for years, people would say, you know, the Arctic's warming at double the rate, and then just in the last few years, that became triple the rate of the global average, and then now the most generally accepted ratio is a factor of four times warmer than the rest of the planet. Of course, if you're living in a northern country, you know, the further north you go, the higher the temperature rise. If you're up in the high Arctic, the temperatures there are rising about 5 to 7 or 8 times faster than the global average. And we're also seeing rapid rises in the last number of years, say within the last decade, in Antarctica. And in Antarctica, the sea ice was growing about 1.5% per decade for 3 or 4 decades until 2015, 2016, when it dropped off a cliff. And the Antarctic region is warming roughly double the rate that the global average warming is. So this polar amplification of temperatures means that different countries experience very different things depending on their geographic location, mostly their latitude.
Well, the tropics may not be increasing at such a great rate, of course, but they are already so hot, they're right at the upper level of human tolerance and crop tolerance. So even a small fraction of a degree hotter on average means quite a bit to the people living there. Now, Berkeley Earth says a quarter of Earth experienced locally record warm annual averages, including 32% of all land. And that puts 40% of Earth's population, 3.3 billion people, in record heat. It includes two-thirds of people in China and a third of Americans living not just through heat, but never before seen heat for a large part of the year. This sounds like a big heat event that is not being reported. People don't sort of assemble all these facts and put it together. Do you think most people do notice, though? Do they know?
I often say that we're living in the climate casino, and more of us are experiencing bad luck. And, you know, if you get bad luck in the climate casino, you might lose your crops if you're a farmer, you might lose your house if you're on a floodplain, or, you know, just look at the people living in Los Angeles. And that's a combination of what I call, you know, weather whiplashing, because a year ago they had record rainfall and it allowed all of the shrubs and chaparral, like the crops, the ground cover to grow. And then it was dry as a bone in the summer of last year. That drought has continued to now. So from October 1st of 2023 to now, they would normally get about 4.25 inches of rainfall down in that region of covering L.A., and thus far, they're at 0.14 inches of rain, so basically bone dry. And they have the phenomena called the Santa Ana winds, where the dry air comes down the mountains and gets compressed, adiabatically heated. And you can get, you know, 100-mile-an-hour winds through the valleys, and the humidity is is 5% or lower, relative humidity. So, you know, any spark and everything goes up. I mean, they don't have, most buildings are wooden structures and extremely flammable. So this isn't even in wildfire season for southern L.A., so Southern California. So there's more and more people that are getting unlucky in the climate casino. It's not just the heat waves. It's the distribution of water, of course, that changes, not just for feeding, keeping rivers and lakes and reservoirs with water. It's also the water vapor. In a warmer world, the water can hold 7% more water vapor per degree Celsius rise in temperature, and that leads to about 2 or 3% more torrential rainstorms when it does happen, but also it means that we have to worry about something called the wet bulb temperature in these heat waves. And if you get a combination of high humidity and high temperature, then the human body is just not able to dissipate heat. So you basically can't be outside for more than 6 to 8 hours. You get heat exhaustion, heat stroke, and end up dying, you know, just by sitting in the shade in those sort of conditions. So the relative humidity is also very, very important. And there's parts of the world that are rapidly approaching this wet bulb temperature during some of their heat wave temperatures.
Yes, I think water vapor has really been underestimated. According to Copernicus, quote, the total amount of water in the atmosphere reached a record value in 2024 at 4.9% above the 1991-2020 average, markedly higher than in 2016 and 2023, the years with the second and third highest values. So isn't water vapor one of the most plentiful and most powerful greenhouse gases up there in the atmosphere, Paul?
Yes, yes, it is. I mean, water vapors, you know, with warmer temperatures and you get more water vapor in the atmosphere, as the water vapor continues to rise, it, then if there's cloud condensation nuclei, then it can, on aerosols mostly, and form clouds, low-level clouds, higher-level clouds, which then blocks some sunlight and cause some cooling. But while it's in the form of water vapor, it's a gas, and it's got a very high absorption coefficient for infrared radiation or heat that's radiating up from the Earth's surface. So it's a huge contributor to, you know, a huge feedback effect, which can accelerate the warming as well while it's there. So water vapor is, it's a vital part of the climate system, and more water vapor can lead to accelerated warming, well, not to mention the torrential rain storms that we're seeing, you know, the other conditions that where it's bone dry, you know, in regions that would normally have decent rainfall. I mean, if the rainfall patterns have shifted and, you know, and they have more heat waves and more drying than if the air is bone dry, then it pulls water vapor. The evaporation rates are higher from lakes and rivers, et cetera. And also it pulls water vapor out of the soils and, over time completely desiccate and dry out the soils. And then regions are more prone to having dust clouds and when there's wind events, let alone crop failures, et cetera. And the problem is that the jet streams, which guide sort of weather patterns, are slowing down and becoming wavier. If you get these ridges of the jet streams over different crop areas in the northern hemisphere, you could have multiple crop failures simultaneously, and then we have a huge problem with our global food supplies. So there's a cascading increase of risk, I guess, that's resulting from climate change.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Canadian climate system scientist Paul Beckwith, and we're looking at the state of warming in 2024. The five big climate reports that just came out are all from Western agencies. I know China invested heavily in climate science, so I looked into what they are saying. Well, last July, the China Meteorological Administration released their Blue Book on Climate Change in China 2024. And according to their meteorological press release, their global warming estimate was, quote, about 1.2 degrees C higher than that in pre-industrial level, 1850 to 1900. So China has lower estimates than Western agencies, well below 1.5 degrees set in the Paris Accords. Their report stresses that China is greening and has fewer dust storms, which are both good news items, so their English version is pretty low-key. Considering the massive climate-induced hits of storms and floods in China over the last 2 years, and the insufferable heat many in big cities this year for almost a billion citizens, I find it strange they're so conservative in reporting warming. Do you have any thoughts on this, Paul?
It's hard to just make a guess as to why that's the case, but you know, China's always had the sort of reputation that, well, they're building, you know, a new coal plant every week, and their emissions are dwarfing that of other countries now and so on. But the Chinese political system allows them to get things done that they want to get done. And basically, they don't have climate denial people in China. Climate denialism is a U.S. product, I think, and also, and then that spread to the U.K. and other parts of Europe, climate denialism. In China's five-year plan, I mean, they were going to level emissions and have them drop from 2030 onwards, but there's some reports, about half of the so-called experts that look at emissions say that China is likely to peak in their fossil fuel emissions in 2025 or 2026, and that the amount of electricity generated by solar power in China is doubling every 3 years. So it's expected to pass all electricity generated by nuclear next year, all energy, electrical energy generated by wind the year after, and within 10 years, it will have increased more than a factor of 10 times the amount of electricity generated just from solar alone, and that will surpass electricity generation from all other sources. And that's a huge economic thing because they can generate, with economies of scale, et cetera, they can generate this electricity at much lower rates than, say, fossil fuel-powered power stations, et cetera, fracking, coal, all these other things. So it's just going to become an economic thing. It's not going to be active phasing out of fossil fuel emissions. It's going to be, economically, it doesn't make sense to power things from fossil fuels. And if you look at the electric car industry, for example, in China, they used to have 300 different companies building electric cars. That's consolidated in the last few years down to about 100 or so. And they can produce fully operating high-tech electric cars for about $13,000 now. And that could flood the world with cheap electric cars of high-tech cars. But, of course, Western countries are throwing up 100% tariffs on these products so that they can still maintain their fossil fuel-producing car industries. And, of course, battery electrical power storage is growing in leaps and bounds in China. They're leading the world in that, not just in lithium battery type storage, but also in pumped water storage and many other areas. So, I mean, China has a culture of learning. They have a culture of education. They produce three times more engineers than Western countries. And if you look at all different aspects of science, they take it seriously. And they're growing in leaps and bounds, whereas, if you're in a high school in the U.S., and you're into the books and a sort of a keener, an egghead, you don't have any recognition. In fact, you're mocked by people in the school who are cheering for the football leader of the football team or the prom queen. The whole idea of how we see learning and education is completely different between the West and China. So I think China's the hope, the big hope for the world to address climate, actually, to be honest. I don't see the West doing much at the moment.
You just hit a nerve, I'll tell you, because I ran for president of the student council in high school and was defeated by the quarterback of the football team. I came out with a program of what we could do, and he came out and said, well, you all know me. I think we'll do great. And, of course, he was elected. So that tells you something. Now, Saudi Arabia doesn't issue an annual report on global warming. They don't care. And like most countries, including the United States and Russia, they profit by producing more emissions. The Trump team has already demanded control over the next U.S. National Climate Assessment, which is due out in 2026 or 27. Maybe that report never comes out, or it is full of lollipops and lies. Are you worried about climate science? Maybe next year's report from NASA, NOAA, will not be reliable.
Yeah, I mean, Trump's also threatened to completely eliminate NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. The National Hurricane Center is part of NOAA. Presumably, they'd still want to track hurricanes coming into Florida. Although maybe Trump's team would take over with their magic markers and arrows pointing on whiteboards. Well, here's where it's going, sort of thing. It's hard to be optimistic about what's happening in the U.S. I mean, it looks like they're heading towards becoming a petrostate again. In the short term, I mean, they might make lots of money from expanding fossil fuel. I mean, Canada's not scot-free. In Alberta, the premier wants to double fossil fuel production from the tar sand / oil sand. In the medium to long term, these petrostates are basically shooting themselves in the foot because the world will just move away from them. You know, when we can get cheaper power generation from clean energy, then it will make the fossil fuel industry kind of irrelevant, and it'll just die an economic, you know, death because it's too expensive.
I love your optimism. Okay. Well, look.
Well, my optimism actually requires carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere, methane removal, and it also requires cooling the planet with solar radiation management techniques. Those things are vital legs of the three-legged bar stool, which is behind my optimism, I think.
Well, I'm not sure about the geoengineering aspect. I just don't know, but we may get that desperate. Now, Berkeley Earth says, quote, "The warming spike in 2023-2024 suggests that the past warming rate is no longer a reliable predictor of the future, and additional factors have created conditions for faster warming, at least in the short term," end quote. So this kind of talk and a host of feedback effects makes me frustrated with the chorus of experts still saying the 1.5 danger line has not been crossed. They want us to wait another 10 years or 30 years to confirm it, and by then it's way too late. I know this bothers you too, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it discredits the whole UN organization that, you know, every report I see where we still mention this magical wishful thinking that we can keep it to 1.5, and then they change their tune slightly, and they still talk about 1.5, and they say, well, we'll have overshoot maybe to 1.6 or 1.7, and then we'll get back to 1.5. I think this really discredits them when they continue statements like that. I mean, we're heading to 2 and rapidly, and if we wait 10 years, you know, hope that we're, you know, and then we can say, well, we exceeded 1.5 because we have 10 years above 1.5. We'll have years above 2 by that point. And then it just carries on in a cycle. So we're heading to rapidly heading to a much warmer world. And if you look at UK actuaries, so these are people, actuaries, financial analysts, they're basically saying that in the future, not so distant future, we just won't be able to pay for anything. Like, our societies are just going to collapse. I mean, countries will go bankrupt. We just won't have money to do things. This is what normally dry as paint actuaries are saying in the UK in this report. And it's already happening with the insurance industry. You know, the reinsurance companies are just, they're having to deny insurance to people. They're having to put clauses into insurance policies. So, you know, you think you might be covered, but because you didn't do steps 1 to 5 or before the fire, you know, you're no longer covered. Insurance is vital for our world because if you're not insured, then it means that if you were to buy a house or sell that house, it would have to be somebody who pays in cash because a mortgage couldn't be taken out on an uninsured property. And then that means that the housing market prices go way down and, it cascades through the financial system. So there's just so many things happening. It's hard to keep all the connections in mind.
Yeah, and I think the key to many things, from ocean currents to survival of living species, is the rate of warming. I mean, yes, Earth is getting hotter, but worse, it's getting hotter faster. Now, Copernicus says the global average temperature was 0.12 degrees C higher than the previous annual value in 2023. So 0.12 degrees C in a single year, by my calculations, if Earth was to continue warming at that rate, it would hit 2.5 degrees C of warming before 2035. Is that an unreal expectation? And tell us why an increasing rate of warming is so dangerous.
Well, I'll go back to some of Hansen's work. I mean, the planet was basically warming about 0.18 degrees Celsius per decade from 1970, 1980, 1990, up until about 2010, and then the rate seemed to accelerate to at least 50% higher, perhaps even as much as double. So it went from 0.18 degrees Celsius per decade to between 0.27 and 0.36, according to his papers, you know, from a year ago or longer ago. And if you look at the actual numbers now, they're even higher than the 0.36. It's more like 0.4. And then, so you're talking now about 0.12, which is a number, which is the one-year warming. So, you know, I said Hansen went up to 0.4. You know, you're not, what you're saying is if it continued, it would be, you know, 1.2 or something. But, I mean, that's unlikely that it would be that high. I mean, El Niño's, ENSO's come into play. You know, we had an ENSO, which then ended, you know, more heat from the ocean. But, you know, the numbers are just climbing, and they're getting, it's just hard to wrap our heads around how fast things are changing and the great acceleration. And, you know, I think the mainstream scientists will come on board probably this year, probably hopefully sooner than later, saying that, yeah, the jump in 2024 and 2023 is because of the reduction of shipping fuels, of sulfur in shipping fuels in the commercial ships plying the oceans. So, you know, once you've got the sulfur out, you're not going to get another jump for a while, probably.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, we just had George Saloniotis on the show, and he was explaining that there have been changes in low cloud cover, especially around the tropical band, that would be adding to heating in addition to the ship emissions. He has worked with Hansen, and he agrees shipping emissions are important, but he was looking for something more and found it and told us about it. I think it was on last week's show.
The clouds are vital, and the Earth's climate system is so sensitive to cloud cover. So, yeah, I mean, if we have reduction of cloud cover of a percent or two, then the warming rate shoots up an equal amount. I mean, you know, you can double the CO2 and calculate the warming, you know, and that's a much slower process even than cloud cover. If you mess with the cloud cover, it's huge. And this is why, you know, I mean, we're destroying our planet. So we're going to have to, you know, let's put some sulfur in the upper atmosphere and generate high-level cirrus clouds and block some of the sunlight. You know, we know this happens when large volcanoes go off, right? So, I mean, the thing is, you know, we're doing everything stupidly now, and we don't have to continue doing everything stupidly. And maybe, you know, when another 10,000 houses are destroyed in another city, you know, maybe Hollywood will put climate change in every movie going forward.
You know, I doubt it. They almost burned down. They, you know, they had a fire reaching almost to Hollywood Boulevard itself. Many big parts of the music industry did burn down. And I'll bet you that doesn't really change much there because of the oligarchy that's forming. Now, some scientists predict 2025 will be a bit cooler than 24. The UK Met Office forecast indicates it's likely 2025 will be the third or second, maybe, warmest year on record globally. What are your expectations for 2025, Paul?
It'll be in the top, say, 5 or 10 for sure. I mean, probably third. I mean, that sounds... I don't think it's going to continue, you know, as much as a jump in 2024 and 2023 relative to 2022. But I mean, also a better indication of sort of the long-term effect is what the ocean temperature is, the sea surface temperature and the ocean heat content, which we can actually quite accurately measure both of those things. And it's really the ocean heat content. I mean, the oceans are absorbing about 90% of the heat, and they're warming and they're expanding, and you know, if there's year-to-year changes, the oceans are somewhat buffering that because it takes longer for them to respond to the Earth energy. And we're talking about the Earth energy imbalance, really, right? The amount of energy coming in versus the amount of energy leaving, you know, and as we get more and more energy coming in and less leaving, you know, we're getting, you know, accelerated warming. So So it's hard to make a prediction just on 1 year, but I'd guess that I'd be very hard pressed to see 2025 being warmer than the previous 2 years.
So wrapping up here, in 1988, German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche said, "What doesn't kill me makes me stronger." Now, with all the heat and the storms and the troubles to come, it sounds like the survivors of 2050 will be very strong indeed. After talking with hundreds of scientists, myself and all of them pretty logical, I've become a bit of a doomer. I know that you have some faith in technology to change our situation, but if that doesn't happen, if we're just sort of socially enabled, and that's what it's increasingly looking like, how do you feel about it then?
Yeah, I think the pain is going to get a lot worse before it turns. But, you know, some of these techniques to cool the planet are we know that they're going to work because of volcanics. Like, I'm talking about sulfur, stratospheric aerosol injection of sulfur, I guess, specifically. We know it will cool the planet. We can cool the planet a degree, half a degree, you know, on, say, a six-month time frame. And it's well within the financial capabilities of single people on the planet. Some of the billionaires can do it. So if we can just knock some sense in, but that may even horrify people even more. But I think the positive thing, I've mentioned, you know, what China's doing in terms of, you know, getting away from fossil fuels with clean energy, but the Earth system is very, very sensitive to things like sulfur and cloud cover and things. So if we come up with ways to modify them in our favor, the cloud cover and other things, and then we can really cool the planet on a short-term basis and buy us time to, you know, completely go to clean energy and things like that. So I have to kind of maintain some sort of modicum of optimism, I guess. And those are the things that I've come up with. You know, the idea of cutting fossil fuels, you know, I don't have, you know, hope or optimism that we're gonna actually do that, because I haven't seen any signs of that happening. You know, it'll happen economically if other things are cheaper.
From Ottawa, Canada, we've been speaking with climate system scientist Paul Beckwith. You can try to keep up with Paul's great teaching videos as he tries to keep up with a continuous fire hose of jaw-dropping research that comes out. He's on the net at paulbeckwith.net, and his YouTube kingdom with over 1,000 science videos is pretty easy to find. Just search for Paul H. Beckwith. As always, Paul, thank you for spending time with us.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.